funding for NJ Spotlight News provided by the members of the New Jersey Education Association, making public schools great for every child, and RWJ Barnabas Health. Let's be healthy together.
Tonight on NJ Spotlight News, tense talks between the U.S. and Israel today after swift international backlash condemning the horrific attack on aid workers with the World Central Kitchen.
It's also tragic that the killing of thousands of Palestinians, over 30,000 by this point, haven't been a sufficient turning point.
Plus, the fallout from the county line court decision continues. Without Andy Kim in the 3rd Congressional District race, candidates are scrambling to get their names out there.
Just because you're going to have equal ballot placement going forward doesn't mean that an unknown candidate is all of a sudden going to be catapulted.
Also, a new unemployment report reveals more than 700,000 workers in the state are left behind by the current unemployment payment system. And chronic absenteeism. New Jersey students are missing more school than prior to the start of the COVID-19 pandemic.
The students that are seeing the highest rates of absenteeism are students that are homeless at about 40%, and there's also high rates among students who are in foster care.
NJ Spotlight News begins right now.
From NJPBS Studios, this is NJ Spotlight News with Brianna Venosi.
Good evening and thanks for joining us this Thursday night. I'm Brianna Venosi. Tensions between the Biden administration and Israeli government are at a new high. President Biden and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today spoke by phone for the first time since an Israeli drone strike killed 7 aid workers on Monday in Gaza. Biden reportedly expressed outrage to Netanyahu over the death of the employees with U.S.-based charity World Central Kitchen and called the conditions in Gaza, quote, woefully inadequate and unacceptable. The Israeli military initially apologized for the deadly strike, calling it a mistake, even though the workers were traveling in clearly marked cars in coordination with Israeli authorities. According to international reports, the IDF today concluded its initial investigation into that incident. The report is pending, but international and domestic political pressure has been mounting on the Israeli government. Secretary of State Antony Blinken today said the attack wasn't the first on aid workers in Gaza, but it must be the last, as the White House noted the civilian death toll from the war. That frustration so far hasn't shifted U.S. policy and support for Israel, but there's increasing speculation it could be a turning point in the war. For more on that, I'm joined by Youssef Munayer, head of the Palestine-Israel program at the Arab Center in Washington, D.C. Youssef Munayer, thank you so much for your time. How has this latest event with regard to the aid workers with World Central Kitchen changed the public discourse about the way this war is being waged in Gaza?
Yeah, well, I think it certainly seems like a turning point, although we have seen many similar strikes for months now. Clearly have led to the killing of civilians, Palestinian civilians, which haven't been turning points, unfortunately. There is a possibility that this might be different now, and we're seeing increased condemnation of this strike from around the world. From, of course, the Palestinian perspective, this is not only a tragic event, the killing of these aid workers by the Israeli military, but it's also tragic that the killing of thousands of Palestinians, over 30,000 by this point, haven't been a sufficient turning point. And this is a disparity that's not lost on Palestinians during this time. But one can only hope that these aid workers, along with the thousands of Palestinians that have been killed, did not die in vain. And that there will be change and enough pressure brought upon the Israeli military to end these strikes and to end this war.
President Biden offered, obviously, some of his most emotional comments, but also some of his most pointed criticism of Israel. and yet in the same breath authorized more arms without conditions to be sent to Israel. What, if anything, should we make of that? Is that something we should consider new light being shed on those pointed comments?
We can look at the comments, but I think actions speak much louder than words. And the reality is that the tap of arms to Israel has not been shut off. It's been flowing at full capacity from this White House to the Israeli military. And that speaks louder, I think, than anything else. Look, the White House, there's no doubt right now. They understand that they have a political problem. Americans broadly, and especially Democrats, are outraged by what they're seeing happening in Gaza. They're outraged that the United States has not done more to stop it. And it's no surprise, we're in an election year, and they're trying to manage these constituencies. But the one message that they're trying to send with their words is undercut by the much louder message that they're sending with their actions. And that, too, is not lost on voters here in the United States.
Yeah. What do you say then about the way that the IDF enforces rules of engagement against Hamas? I have been reading pieces from folks who have intelligence both on the IDF and the ground operation that have somewhat insinuated it's a bit of a business as usual.
Well, you know, if you've been following the ins and outs of this war on a daily basis, the different strikes that we've seen, and so much of it in this day and age with the technology that we have is available on video for people to see. The amount of information that's out there about these strikes shows a complete and callous disregard for human life. And even based on the story that the Israeli media is reporting from Israeli defense sources on the strike that killed these aid workers, the story that they put out there is they thought they saw one armed person that they suspected to be a militant get in this convoy. And that somehow was justification for striking a convoy that they knew also contained all of these aid workers. And so this is their best explanation for what happened. And even with that, it involves a justification for killing these aid workers. So those are the rules that they seem to be going by. And it explains why we've seen such massive civilian casualties in this war.
Why aren't there controls, Youssef, on aid convoys, such as having IDF escort the aid workers, or controls maybe requested by the U.S.? Why haven't we seen that until this point?
Well, look, that actually was in place with this convoy. Their location, their path, their timing was all coordinated with the Israeli military, and still they were targeted. And by the way, they were not just targeted with one strike. The first car in the convoy was hit. The people who were injured from that strike attempted to evacuate in another vehicle. That vehicle was hit. And then the third vehicle was hit. Really, what happened here was an extermination of these people, one after the other.
Youssef Munayyer is the head of the Palestine-Israel program at the Arab Center in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for your insight.
Thanks for having me.
Well, a surprising turn of events in the legal battle over the so-called party line. A majority of county clerks have now dropped their motions to appeal federal Judge Karashi's recent injunction blocking Democrats' use of the county line ballot system for this June's primary. That ruling has all but reset the race in the 3rd Congressional District among candidates vying to replace Representative Andy Kim, acting as a blessing for lesser-known contenders and a curse for those who already had a clean sweep of county endorsements. Senior correspondent Brenda Flanagan takes a look.
I think more than any other district in the state, this is the one that's getting the biggest reset from the block office ballot.
Writers Micah Rasmussen's talking about the race to fill Senate candidate Andy Kim's seat in Jersey's 3rd Congressional District. Democrats this June will likely confront a whole new ballot design, one that no longer lines up the party boss favorites. That sent political shockwaves rocking candidates for Congress in Kim's home district, where Assemblyman Herb Conaway had scored the advantageous line in all three counties. But now,
all of Herb Conaway's advantages that he built up in winning those three lines, which were thought to be a prohibitive advantage for him, are all gone. And it is a great reset in that race now. And it is anybody's game.
I disagree with him. We are. We have shown and demonstrated that we can win before and engaging smaller groups of Democrats. I would expect to enjoy the same success as we move to a larger stage in the primary election.
Conaway's a physician who spent 25 years in the legislature. He's drawn overwhelming support from county Democratic committee members, racked up weighty endorsements, and favors a cohesive party. He believes in the county line and expresses reservations about the lawsuit to abolish it as unconstitutional, ironically filed by Andy Kim.
You know, I have to study it. I do have a concern that a measure like this might end up weakening the parties. And as I say, I do believe we need strong parties. I mean, you hear this in the commentary all the time.
All bets are off, and it's now a competitive race.
Democrat Carol Murphy previously ran for assembly on the county line alongside her former teammate Conaway and won. But as his opponent for Congress, she's a convert to the new office block ballot.
Yes, I've been converted. And I appreciate what Andy Kim did, knowing that the line has fallen. It's allowed me, and along with my other running mates, to be able to continue on to the primary to allow the people to make their voice.
Murphy commissioned an internal poll of registered Democrats, which shows Conaway leads with 22%, followed by Murphy with 18 and two other candidates who logged less than 5% each. But with 49% undecided and a 5-point margin of error.
You know what? I think it brings it back to neutral. It brings it back to the fact that, he might have got the county line. But I'm also being reached out by a few of the county members as well that want to have that were not part of that convention, right?
But ditching the county line also opens up the field a bit more for first-time candidates like civil rights attorney Joe Cohn and seafood company co-owner Sarah Schoengood, who was also a plaintiff in the county line lawsuit.
It's evening the playing field in terms of just having fair placement on the ballot. The county line is so crazy that it's hard to process, like, oh, what are you saying? Where's your name going to be on the ballot? So this just, you know, this allows people to vote for me if they want to. There will be visibility. My name will be there.
And the new ballot could create a bigger potential for spoilers as the race tightens, Rasmussen says.
We don't know who that front runner is going to be, but could one of those other candidates serve as a sort of spoiler and peel off votes from one of the two front running candidates? It's entirely possible.
He says campaigns will still depend on resources and Conaway can still count on the Democratic Party's formidable get-out-the-vote support. I'm Brenda Flanagan, NJ Spotlight News.
New Jersey's public schools are having an alarming problem with absenteeism. A statewide performance report released this week showed a significant uptick in the number of kids missing school. In fact, the rate of chronic absenteeism is worse than before the COVID-19 pandemic, when the number hovered around 10.6%. Now, the most recent data, which is for the 2022-23 school year, puts that rate at 16.6%. Education and Child Welfare reporter Hannah Gross is with me now to explain what's driving this change. Hannah, so good to talk to you. Very interesting numbers here. What do we know about why these rates are higher?
Experts say you really have to look at the root causes of absenteeism, and that could be different in different school districts, different schools, or even on an individual level. But some causes are people are staying home more often when they're sick following the pandemic. Mental health has been a big factor. With students taking mental health days or not feeling well enough to go into the building, there's a ton of things going on.
I'm wondering, when you say mental health and sickness, is it affecting certain groups of kids more than others and kids in certain areas of the state more than others?
It's affecting students that belong to historically marginalized groups the most. The students that are seeing the highest rates of absenteeism are students that are homeless at about 40%, and there's also high rates among students who are in foster care.
How about other groups, typically marginalized groups? How are they faring when it comes to getting to school and having consistent rates of being at school?
I mean, you could see that rates are higher for Black students, Hispanic students, than for their white and Asian peers. Also, economically disadvantaged students have higher rates, students with disabilities, and English language learners.
So the districts have this data. How are they addressing the problem?
So more than 70% of school districts have populations that have 10% or more of absentee students. And so those districts have to come up with corrective action plans to address this issue with help from the county superintendent.
That's a state requirement that they
yes.
do that. And so does the state also give them help aside from the county superintendent? Does the state offer any resources or money to put toward it?
Yeah, so to address this problem, the state actually released a new website recently that has all of the information in one place. And they're going to be coming out with a toolkit and some like public relations materials that districts can use to drive up attendance rates.
What do we know about what's lost for students when they're chronically missing class?
I mean, if you're not in school, you're not going to be able to learn with the help of your teacher. And if a student is not in school, their classmates then become less likely to go to school. So it can have a big effect, not just on an individual student, but on their peers as well.
These are also, of course, the kids, the students who were affected most by remote learning, by the COVID. And so there's at least ostensibly already a learning gap there, potentially.
Yeah, it makes it much harder to come back from the learning loss if you're not in school.
Yeah, I mean, when you looked at these numbers, were parts of the state, say, in the South or in the North, or areas where we typically see this, were they the ones that stood out, bigger cities or more rural areas?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that economic status is a big determinant of this. Looking at Trenton, you have rates of like 40% or more of absentee students. And then if you look at Milburn, that rate is a lot lower. It's in the single digits. So that's a big driver.
Milburn, of course, an area of a lot of affluent residents. Hannah Gross for us. The report is online on our website. Hannah, thanks so much.
Thanks, Bree.
Stress and burnout are still causing an exodus of workers from New Jersey hospitals. According to the state's largest nurses union, that's because the healthcare facilities are still largely understaffed. The union held a rally in South Jersey this week, urging lawmakers and hospital administrators to move a controversial piece of legislation mandating safe patient-to-staff ratios at a time when other nurses unions have made similar demands with success. Melissa Rose Cooper was there.
The number one nurses are migrating out of hospitals is unsafe staffing. The number two is very closely related, and that is stress due to unsafe staffing. Until we have mandatory staffing ratios, we will never be able to retain the nurses that we hire.
Debbie White, president of the Health Professionals and Allied Employees Union, expressing her frustration over what she says is an ongoing staffing crisis in hospitals. HPAE releasing a new position paper titled Code Red, where data from a 2022 statewide survey shows nearly a third of nurses have left the bedside in the past 3 years. Of those nurses that remain, 72% have considered leaving recently, and newer nurses are the most likely to consider leaving. 95% of those have 5 years or less experience.
We can recruit and recruit and recruit, but we will never fill all our positions because as we recruit, nurses continue to leave the bedside.
So nurses and other healthcare workers are demanding hospital administrators and lawmakers improve conditions on the job. Legislation known as the Patient Protection and Safe Staffing Act would mandate safe patient-to-staff ratios in hospitals.
As nurses, we know how important it is to have enough nurses on a unit to provide the highest quality of care to our patients. And we know the right number of patients we should be providing care to during our shifts.
Doris Bell is president of the HPAE Local 5118 at Cooper University and is currently in negotiations with the hospital to improve nurse-to-patient ratios within their contracts.
If by having fewer patients, we're able to spend more time with the patients, we can communicate better and with them and their families. It is those conversations that can ease some of their anxiety and help them to understand the information they need to know so they can get better.
Every night when I come home, I'm like, did I do a good enough job with my patients, because I feel like every day that I'm working, I feel overwhelmed by all these responsibilities I have to take on as a nurse.
But hospitals aren't supportive of a patient-to-staff ratio mandate. Kathy Bennett, the president and CEO of the New Jersey Hospital Association, releasing a statement saying delivering quality, equitable care is job one for New Jersey hospitals and their 150,000 team members. Thanks to their skills and dedication, New Jersey is recognized nationally for safe, reliable health care. Inflexible nurse staffing ratios are a static and ineffective tool inconsistent with modern clinical practice. A one-size-fits-all nurse staffing ratio emphasizes staff roles of yesterday rather than a collaborative, team-based model that places the patient firmly at the center.
We now have a wealth of data showing the enormous benefits to patients, to nurses, and even to the hospitals. With mandatory nurse-to-patient assignments, patients have better outcomes, less complications, lower death rates, and much higher patient satisfaction scores.
Healthcare workers say they'll continue to fight for better staffing ratios so they can provide their patients with the quality care they deserve. For NJ Spotlight News, I'm Melissa Rose Cooper.
In our Spotlight on Business report, New Jersey's unemployment system has come a long way since the peak of joblessness during the pandemic. But a new report finds, even with those improvements, the state system is leaving out more than 700,000 residents. As Ted Goldberg reports, research largely blames the barriers on federal regulations that are more likely to affect people of color, immigrants, and low-wage workers.
The Center for Popular Democracy wanted to find out how many out-of-work people in New Jersey are actually collecting unemployment.
How can we really bring people together and make sure everyone is fully covered in a system that is as seamless as possible that works within the limitations of the law?
After combing through publicly available data, they wrote a report saying New Jersey's current unemployment insurance system still leaves behind more than 700,000 workers. Despite that, the report compliments New Jersey for being one of the few states to issue unemployment to about half of people who aren't working.
We are consistently one of the best states in terms of access to unemployment benefits and benefit levels. So it's no accident. Our staff works tirelessly with claimants to provide benefits whenever possible.
They have a pretty good definition of good cause separation or for when workers leave voluntarily. So, you know, if there's something illegal going on at a workplace, say they're having their wages stolen, say there is a threat to their health and safety, they're able to leave that workplace and have a good chance of being able to submit an effective claim.
Julie Diaz is the Deputy Commissioner for New Jersey's Department of Labor. She says the state could modernize a bit more to help more eligible people find benefits, but that a revamped unemployment website has been a big help.
One of the drivers of this department is to provide equitable access. And we work hard to reach some of the most vulnerable populations. Our work through the community partners is doing a lot of that in reaching workers and ensuring that eligible workers are receiving benefits.
Since the program is a state-federal program, the federal kind of limitations and guidelines really do have a big impact on what a state can do directly with that program, since it's subsidized by the federal government.
Being subsidized by the federal government means you have to play by their rules. That makes it harder for certain groups of people to collect unemployment, including gig workers, students, and immigrants who entered the country illegally.
We know that the impacts of unemployment on families are drastic. Young people, children of unemployed parents have worse test scores.
Sarah Cullinane leads Make the Road New Jersey, a group that partners with the Center for Popular Democracy. She wants to see major changes to how New Jersey gives out unemployment insurance. And Deputy Commissioner Diaz doesn't totally disagree.
What we can do as a state is start a new program, a permanent program, one that really fits the needs of a 21st century workforce that includes immigrant workers, gig workers, workers who are returning after a period of being a caregiver, students, others that are excluded.
We need national reform to the UI statutes to make everything more uniform and modernization across the board so states can work together. There are 53 systems in this country right now. States must be able to talk to each other
New Jersey's unemployment rate has hovered around 5% since last summer. Federal data puts that at one of the higher rates for American states. While this report says New Jersey has done a great job of keeping unemployed people afloat, even if there's still progress to be made. For NJ Spotlight News, I'm Ted Goldberg.
Turning to Wall Street, stocks jumped today, shaking off a rough start to the quarter. Here's how the markets closed. And make sure to tune in to NJ Business Beat with Raven Santana this weekend. April is Financial Literacy Month in New Jersey. Raven talks to educators and advocates about the importance of financial education, along with the programs available to improve your financial literacy. Watch it Saturday morning at 10 on the NJ Spotlight News YouTube channel. And that's going to do it for us tonight. But don't miss Reporters Roundtable tomorrow. David Cruz talks to Micah Rasmussen, director of the Rebovich Institute for New Jersey Politics at Rider University, about the fallout from the historic ruling on the party line lawsuit, plus the latest on the U.S. Senate and congressional primary races and the fate of that OPRA reform bill. Then a panel of local reporters break down this week's political headlines. Watch Roundtable tomorrow at noon on the NJ Spotlight News YouTube channel. I'm Brianna Venosi for the entire NJ Spotlight News team. Thanks for being with us. Have a great evening. We'll see you tomorrow.
NJM Insurance Group, serving the insurance needs of residents and businesses for more than 100 years. And by the PSCG Foundation.